Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a very happy Tuesday to everybody, the first Tuesday of February, February 7th, 2023. This is Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm great, Chase. It's awesome to be in February because it means we're, you know, within a month of the best month of the year here. So,
yeah, and this is actually, you know, February is a pretty good month for college basketball too. I mean, quite frankly, I mean, these games have been, you know, we had some exciting games over the weekend we touched upon on the last pod, and we're heading into some very important games. So I think before we jump into it on where these SC games coming up this weekend, or Thursday through Saturday, we should just kind of, I want to hit really quickly where we are on the tournament. We're basically stayed even for where we had been heading into the kind of post Washington State game. So according to Bracket Matrix, which is kind of like the aggregator of a lot of these, you know, everyone's brackets, some, many of whom are amateur, but you know, there is like 97 of them encompassed into this site. So it's interesting to see we're on every single, every single person's all 97 brackets, except for one. I'm not sure whose bracket we missed. I don't know if it's dated or something. We're basically, you know, consensus number 10. I know Jerry Palm has us higher. I think Lenardi, as the most recent winning, I think he still has a set of 10. Is that right? Do you know?
Yeah. So he, well, Lenardi, he just like, I don't know what he's doing half the time because he bumped us from an 11 to a 9 without playing. And then we beat the Washingtons and then went back 10 line. So yeah. I think he's just kind of making it up as he goes along here.
Well, yeah, I think, and it's a lot's happening with the teams around us. And we've discussed this before. There's so much parity, especially after, you know, the 1 and 2 seeds, and even there, there's parity. But so we're in a spot where we're in comfortably right now, but it's not a sure thing. We have to keep performing. We can't, you know, our current status is based upon our performance, really, starting with Thanksgiving time period and especially the last month or so of college basketball. And so we've got to keep performing at that level. And if we do perform at that level, we'll even move up a little more. I know in the, you know, KenPom and Torvik were kind of in the 40 range. Sagarin's has his 35 once pop behind Duke. And that's interesting because Duke doesn't look particularly scary this year, but it gives us a general idea of where we kind of look. So, and we're heading into this huge weekend. So Thursday, we're at Matthew Knight Arena or Matthew Knight Court, whichever one's called, up in Eugene to play Oregon. We won there last year. It's not a place we've been to often. Obviously, last year, Everyone remembers it was that big three that Drew hit in our final possession of the game that gave us the victory. It was a game where I think going into the game, we weren't sure Boogie was going to play. He did play, but he was not super effective. Was it him? Was it he or was it Reese? I think it was Reese who we weren't sure was going to play, and he did play. But our team was pretty banged up going into that game last year, and we're pretty banged up again. You know, we know about the injury to Joshua Morgan, which is a more severe sprain. I'm hopeful that Reese will be back. I mean, he basically played the end of the Washington State game. I think he probably could have played if he needed to on Saturday if it was a true emergency. We didn't deem it was. And then Kobe apparently has his own little ankle issue. Was a game time decision, they said. I mean, I think playing that Washington game without all three of those guys would have been kind of nuts. But thank God Kobe played because he played the game, you know, the end of the season for us in many ways. And I think he'll hopefully be close to 100% going into Oregon, but you never know. Of course, Oregon is actually, you know, they tend to be injured generally the last couple seasons. They seem to be more healthy than they have traditionally been, but they tend to get there this time of year. I'm not sure where to take this conversation, but Let's just really briefly, I want to look at, you know, where, since SD started playing so strongly right when Vince returned, so we're talking about right around January 11th to the present, where is SC compared to other teams? And, you know, Petorvik has a great tool to kind of to figure that out. So he has us number 20, playing the number like 23rd best in the country since essentially Vince started playing for us. He has Oregon as the fourth best team in the conference. We're the third best, obviously, but quite a ways back behind us. So now that being said, that encompasses a bad loss Oregon had on the road to Stanford. Since that's the, you know, Oregon is otherwise, since starting with January 14th, has won 5 of 7 games, and the only other loss is to Arizona. So, I mean, they've been 5-2. They've positioned themselves really kind of like they can strike at the number three spot if they win down the stretch. And that's really a key to that's going to be beating us on Thursday if they can. So it's, for them, it's a really big game. And I think this weekend for them, you know, these games against USC and UCLA, it's their last desperate hope to try to make the NCAA tournament.
No doubt. Yeah. You know, they looked okay on that road trip to the Arizona schools. I thought, Arizona is just playing at a really high level right now. So I don't really hold that loss against them. You know, they're beating everybody down there at McHale. And then they didn't seem far superior to ASU to me for most of that game. I think they just had a little more poise down the stretch there, and, you know, credit to them for winning there at Desert Financial. But yeah, like I think if they beat USC and UCLA, they're probably back in the tournament. And if they go 1-for-2, I think they're still on the outside looking in. But you know, it's still doable if they're able to do that. And if they get swept, it's not over them, but it's looking, you know, pretty bleak. So definitely agree with your assessment there.
Yeah, and the other thing probably to note here is, you know, going back to the bracket matrix, out of the 97, oh, I guess maybe there's 105 brackets. 105 brackets. Oh, and SC is in. Okay, so I now I need to update myself from 3 seconds ago. SC is actually in 104 out of 105. So out of the 105 possible brackets that people have submitted, other than Arizona, UCLA, and USC, grand total of 5 of those 107 or 105 brackets, 5 out of the 105 have any other Pac-12 teams other than those three. 3 of them have Arizona State, 2 of them have Oregon. So it's, now that being said, it's a steep drop off. I mean, basically Wisconsin is like the last team out on these. And Wisconsin did not look super great yesterday in losing at home to Northwestern. So you can definitely move up, but Oregon's basically positioned, you know, 8th team out here. So they can move up quite a bit with wins this weekend, and beating UCLA obviously would go a long way toward that if they were to get the sweep. I think just beating SC is not going to do it for now. Now, if they were to beat SC and then kind of win out the rest of the way, they'd be looking pretty good. So that would put them at, let's see, they're currently 14-10. And if they finished 6-1, they'd be at 20-11. Does that get them there? They probably have to do a little work in the Pac-12 tournament, but they would probably then be in the top four, the Pac-12, and they'd have a bye. So, you know, it's an important, this USC game is very, very, very important to their tournament prospects. And if they were to lose, I think it's basically they're done for. I don't really see a path forward for them. And they probably know that. So they're certainly going to make a big deal of this game. You know, what are your thoughts on the way they've looked? Since they kind of got the whole band together, right? That includes, I mean, they've had the pretty much the entire season, they've had Will Richardson, most of it, they've had Nafal Di Dante, and they've had Quincy Guerrier. But The missing pieces had been Keyshawn and Bartholomew, and really their big, you know, offseason transfer, which was Jermaine Cuisinart from South Carolina. I know you're not a huge fan, but he's actually played pretty well since he came back.
Yeah, he did have that really good shooting game against Arizona. I think he went 6 for 8 from three. And kind of since then, he's been shooting more in line with his career averages. So, you know, I know that, you know, all these broadcasts have made a big deal with about him being back, but I don't know. I think he's a nice piece, but I don't think he's a game changer for them. What's been interesting to me, though, is – and Bartholomew, too, right? He's back. He missed a lot of the season, and I do think he's a, you know, pretty good shooter and definitely good enough to be a high major starter. So he's someone that you're going to have to, you know, put on the scouting report and make sure you defend him properly. What's been interesting is their big man rotation. So they've Nate Biddle's basically become a starter for them. Kel-El Ware's been kind of, you know, out of the rotation. He's played some minutes here and there. I know a lot of his teammates have questioned his effort level publicly, which I think is really interesting. So there's definitely something going on behind the scenes there. But, you know, you've seen Biddle move into the starting lineup. You had Dante actually come off the bench for a game in there so they could play Biddle and Guerrier together. And I think that was a, you know, and Paulie Dante selfless gesture where he went up to Altman and said, hey, like, you know, do we want to mix this up and just to try to get a rhythm going with the team. So all that being said, I mean, they, you know, they just won in Tempe. They did very well at the Huntsman Center and beat Utah there by double digits a little while back. They've got that marquee home win against Arizona. So they're dangerous. There's no doubt about it. And when you have a dangerous team that has talent and with their backs against the wall, it's just a really tough spot for SC going in there on Thursday.
Yeah, especially, you know, shorthanded personnel-wise. And this is certainly a game, make no mistake about it. I mean, this is a game where you want to have a guy like Joshua Morgan available, even if it's just minutes, quality minutes at the five. You know, you know, I think maybe you're thinking, okay, over the long run, you know, Vince is going to, you know, is going to perform better at that position. We've seen that in plus minus, but, you know, the drop off now, though, when Vince goes out of the game is pretty stark. Harrison Horner gave some really nice minutes against Washington, but that, a lot of that was without Mie in the game. So it's a little tricky. I mean, Dante is, he's now a senior, you know, this is his fourth year in college. He's rounded into a pretty nice five man who's, you know, has quite a bit of skills, can really get a lot done. Last year, he really caused problems for us at Galen blocking shots. You know, we had a hard time handling him. The hope was in this season, you know, we come in with Vince and he would be neutralized more, but obviously Vince is late to playing. He missed 6 months because of the heart issue. So that's going to be a very important matchup. The big thing for me with Cuisinart and Bartholomew is it essentially means that Oregon didn't have to keep playing like a guy like Brendan Rigsby 30 minutes a game like they were doing. And that makes a huge difference. So, you know, they're just Oregon is a team. You can kind of just tell that there's personnel at the back of the bench there, or you know, off the bench, they're just having issues with personnel. Khalil Ware obviously missed, he had missed a game back in last week. He played this past weekend, but for example, at Arizona State, he played only 13 minutes, had 7 rebounds in 13 minutes, but he also missed the only 3 shots he took. Did get some, free throws and got a block too. So I don't know how much of a factor he'll be. I mean, remember Khalil Ware over the high school all-star game circuit last year, he was playing in a lot of those games with Vince. So, I mean, they know each other. They're kind of, I mean, at the time, I think Ware was thought of as, you know, a better prospect. I think to a certain degree, he still is because he's still on draft boards and Vince isn't, but he's not even playing that much for them. Biddle, you know, it's an interesting decision with Biddle. I guess they're thinking he just comes in with the effort and he does the things that need to be done. I'm not going to second guess that. And the rebounding is helpful. I mean, rebounding and defense as well. It's going to be, if they do play Biddle, you know, he's going to have to cover someone like Trey White. And I think that's actually a matchup that Trey would actually do pretty well in. And I think he would kind of be able to guard Biddle for most area of the court. Obviously, if Biddle gets deep post position, it's not a good situation. But if it's away from the basket a little bit, I think Trey White can kind of handle it. But yeah, Oregon presents some challenges in matchups for us. And Will Richardson, who seems like he's been in college forever, this will be our last time having to play him in Eugene. And he brings a lot. You know, he's had huge games against SC. He's had some duds. I'm sure he's gearing up for a big game on Thursday.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You mentioned Biddle. His best attribute is the defensive glass, right? Like he gets 27% of opponent shots, which is very high. He doesn't rank in the KenPom rankings because just a lack of minutes. But his rate is his defensive rebounding rate's up there with the best in the country. So he's really good at clearing the glass. He can block shots. He's long. I do agree with you that if they do play the two bigs, that's a matchup we can exploit with Trey White or Drew Peterson, attacking him off the dribble and making them guard the space. So I think that's something we can exploit for sure. With Nafali Dante, I'm extremely worried about him on the glass. I mean, you talk about Muhammad Gay as a rebounder or Hedem Bona as a rebounder. Dante in conference play, he's tops in the conference in offensive and defensive rebounding percentage. So he's been a complete monster on there. And certainly that's been one of our weaknesses this year. And then, you know, you take Josh Morgan out of the equation, not that he's an elite rebounder by any stretch, but he's at least a body that you can throw at him, right? So I think we're gonna lose. Like we could win, certainly. I like the way we're playing. It just seems like kind of the wrong matchup at the wrong time for us, and I just think we're gonna have to have one of those games where we hit like 8 or 9 threes to hang.
Yeah, it's good. I think it's a really, really tough matchup with Dante there. Now, the only, you know, he got a little dinged at the end of the Arizona State game. I'm sure he'll go in healthy to the next game, but he's had lingering injury issues. He's only played about 57.5% of the minutes, even in conference play for Oregon. So he's not always in the game. When he's in there, he's going to be a monster. And we're just going to have to figure out a way to try to deal with him. You know, and between Richardson and Cuisinart, those guys have played a lot of college basketball. They are graybeards. You know, they know this. They know the game. Guerrier has played a lot of minutes too, and so they can throw a lot at you. I guess the funny part is, you know, just you look at this. I think Torvik has Oregon winning by 3. I think KenPom has Oregon winning by 3. So they both agree there, but if you were to use just that kind of, the limited metric that we discussed about, just the play since, Vince returned, USC probably would be favored in the game, even though the game's in Eugene. But again, that was based really on Morgan playing with, Vince, and we're not going to have that. So, I guess the other thing maybe we should talk about a little bit, we didn't get any minutes against Washington. We tried everything on Mia and kind of just guarding, you know, at the five, except Johnny Wright. He didn't play any minutes. So not only did we try Vince, the first guy at the bench with Niagu, and then we came in with Harrison Hornery. I think at one point we tried playing small. We never tried Kajani. So I'm not sure what, if they were just kind of disappointed with how he performed against Washington State. You know, again, my read on that is that, yeah, it was not great and there were some issues there, but his biggest issue, I think, is, you know, in many ways is the rebounding. His hands are just not strong enough right now. And that's something he needs to look to improve in the offseason. But I thought as far as just man-to-man defense, he actually, compared to a lot of, you know, what we were doing otherwise, he had done a decent job on Gay as compared to the other guys. So I would not, you know, if we need to use Kajani to just come in and give us some minutes to guard Dante, I would not begrudge Andy for doing that. And I do worry about like a guy like Niagu, although Niagu had some good minutes against Washington. I got to get him credit where credit is due, but I would be very worried about putting Niagu on Dante for more than a couple of possessions.
Yeah, I would too. With Kajani, I do think like he is in the right position a lot of the time, right? So that's kind of the frustrating thing when watching him is that, you know, clearly like he's coachable. He knows where to be. It's just a matter of, right, so securing these rebounds. And it's just been tough to let him conference play, right? He's sub 5% on the defensive glass in conference play, which is extremely low. Like to put that in perspective, that's, you know, under half of Boogie Ellis's defensive rebounding rate for the season. So I think that's kind of the main thing. And I want to say too, like I did like Hornery's minutes against Washington. He spaced the floor a little bit. He didn't make all the shots. But again, like he's good positionally. Kind of like I was saying with Kajani, he knows where to be. You're not going to have a bunch of defensive mistakes with him. He moves the ball. So I wouldn't mind having him as kind of just your second big and just tag teaming Vince and Hornery for most of the game. Yeah. The other thing you could do is you could just say, okay, to hell with it. If they're going to play a bunch of bigs, we're just going to play five out, right? And make Biddle and Dante guard in space. Just go with Drew or Trey at the five and just try to, score a point out per possession, right? That's the other approach. I don't see us doing that, just, knowing Andy's coaching philosophy, but, it's a thought that at least has crossed my mind.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if he did that, but I guess you never know. I just quickly against Washington State, looking at the Hoopland's data. Kajani played about 13, 14 possessions in that game. So in offense, those were the worst possessions of the game when he was in it. Basically, we were averaging only like 0.85 points per possession. The rest of the game, we're averaging close to 1.2 points per possession. So it was way down. But it was actually the best defensive minutes of the game, which is, doesn't surprise me that much. 0.86 points allowed per possession when he was in there. So the offense really struggled. I think a lot of it's just like, yeah, like you mentioned, he's in the right place, but he can't catch the ball. He can't deliver at the rim. But he, on defense, he did, he was effective. At least it looks like it if you were to take these numbers and try to extrapolate them. For that game, Harrison, about 1 point per possession when he was on defense, which is, he was only in for eight possessions, which was about average for the game. 1.57 offensive points per possession when he was in there. So the offense really cooked when Harrison was in there. It was like obviously very small sample size, but that's interesting. For the Washington game, we got both Niagu. So Niagu was in there for about eight possessions. I think the best thing you could say about it is like neither team really scored. I think we scored 4 points and they scored three in eight possessions. Vince was actually, this was Vince's first negative game. We played 40 possessions and we let up more points than we scored when Vince was in the game for the first time since he's played. So that's noteworthy. Harry was stellar. I mean, he killed it, plus minus. Best, other than those crazy minutes from Niagu, second best defensive points per possession allowed, other than Malik, interesting enough, and led the team when he was on the court, 1.29 points per possession. So we really got the offense going when he was in there. How long is this bet between Niagu and Harry going to last? Because it gets more interesting as the season goes on, right?
I've got some buyer's remorse on that, I think. I got to hand it to Hornery. Part of it, too, is he actually got five rebounds in that game, too, right? The Washington game.
Yeah,
two offensive, three defensive. I mean, if you're getting five rebounds in 19 minutes out of Hornery, if he can make like one shot and give you some good positional defense, it's a lot better player just right there than we've been getting out of our backup bigs for most of the season, right? So you gotta hand it to him.
Yeah, and just going back to the Colorado game when Vince, we first saw Vince appear in games, Harry's played about half as many possessions as Vince has. So Harry's, you know, the offense is not stellar when Harry's been overall. It's been about 1 point per possession, which is below average for us. But we're only giving up 0.95 points per possession when he's in there. So he's been a positive impact on the court. Interestingly, Kajani has really strong plus minus. The offense is weak. It was 0.93, but the defense, 0.76 points allowed per possession when he's in the game. So that's just an interesting stat.
For the season?
That's since Colorado game. So that's 42 possessions. I think maybe that's because he's coming in when there's backups in, but that's not clearly not always the case. Vince, you know, the defense has not been there. We're giving up 1.1 points per possession when he's in there, but the offense is the best. So, which is not surprising, right? Because he's a freshman who's had to sit out 6 months and is just trying to get his way. I think we're going to have to use a mix of guys here. I'm not sure if Niagu, when he's in there, it's kind of disruptive for on offense, right? Because it's like, we can't even try to throw him the ball around the basket. He seems to really struggle in catching the basketball. I mean, Kajani struggled too, but not like Niagu. Like Niagu is almost like he played soccer his entire life and now he's just trying to learn a sport where you use your hands. I think it's going to probably be Vince and Harry, and maybe I'm hoping they mix in some Kajani, give him some minutes. I'll select all games and see who's been best on the season for us. It looks like Boogie, Trey are about the same. Yeah, that does not surprisingly, right? Because they played so many minutes and Drew. So all those guys, everyone you'd expect. Kobe's right there too. So we've been pretty consistent, other than kind of like the players that don't play as many minutes.
Let me throw one thing at you too. Yeah. What'd you think of Coach's decision to ride Harry down the stretch over Vince in that game?
I think it actually, in many ways, it did make sense because
I agree.
Really, this is not really a reflection on Vince because Vince barely got to play. It was a reflection on the way the officials were calling the game. You put Vince out there, the first thing that's going to happen, he's going to foul out anyway. So, yeah. I was objecting when Andy started Vince in the second half, especially with Mia starting with three fouls. I was hoping they would come out there with Harry and just kind of do a few possessions, try to give Vince a break. Maybe he comes in when Mia is out because, the way Mia played, he was essentially just a magnet for fouls. Either people are fouling him or he's fouling players. And obviously, even the play where he got, that's a perfect illustration. This is the play he got fouled where he got the fourth foul. He fouled out and Vince got his fourth foul because they called that cheap technical on him. So the way the game was being called and the style of play that Mia was playing, it was hard to even give any minutes at all to Vince. And look, when you're a freshman, it's a combination of not having the best technique and officials already being on the lookout to call fouls when you're big. I mean, you're just a magnet for getting fouls calling you on when you're a freshman, especially in the Pac-12. So I don't have a problem with riding Harry out down the stretch.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, one other thing too, I'll add is, Vince coming off the, long layoff, right? You want him to get into a rhythm on the court, right? Like you don't want to put him in for two possessions and just take him out. Right. So it's hard. It was just the classic game that was, it was really hard to get into any sort of flow or rhythm the way they were calling it. Right.
Yeah.
So even if you were there's 2 minutes left, we want Vince back in there to ride it out. I'm not sure. It's kind of like if you put a jump shooter in, right, for one possession and ask him to go make a three, right? That's just coming off the bench and didn't have the warm-ups, right? So I think he's in a state right now as a player where you need him to have some game flow, kind of in that in the ASU game, right? He really started to assert himself once he got asserted, he had a few possessions under him into the game, and that's when he started seeing a positive impact.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked just briefly about, Oregon State. This is a team we've already played and only beat them by one at Galen. So that's a important thing to remember. They kind of, now that was almost a different team for us in a way. But we're going to go up there shorthanded. We've had some very, very tough games at Corvallis over the years. This is obviously not a – even last year, though, right? Last year was the worst Oregon State team, like, ever. And, it required kind of like a semi-miracle for us to win the game just because every shot that Deshaun Davis took, he hit. And you never know what can happen in the, you know, game – this year. I do think a lot of the, like, what they were doing to, I mean, they really attacked Ethan and Isaiah Mobley in that game. It's a little bit tougher to attack us like that this season. Like, we have not exposed ourselves defensively in a way that, like, teams can just get obvious, you know, mismatches by doing switches against us. So now maybe that will be exposed for the first time against Oregon State. But you know, they've had a decently rough go of it. They did beat Colorado at home at the end of last month, and that's a scary thing to think about. Cause Colorado's a decent team, but, for the most part, they've even struggled at home this season. So, I don't know, any thoughts on this game?
I like this matchup for us. I think we'll be motivated coming off a loss, or not the loss, the near loss to these guys. I do think if we do lose to Oregon too, there's going to be kind of a sense of desperation to get out of the Oregons with a split at a minimum. So I like our chances better against Oregon State if we lose to Oregon. It's really hard for me to see us dropping two up there. I think if we beat Oregon, we'll still be substantially favored against Oregon State. But, you know, you add in, you have the emotional high coming off of a hypothetical Oregon win, combined with your short bench and, you know, the environment up there at Gill Coliseum. It just wouldn't be the best spot. Although, like, they don't have a dynamic player like Deshaun Davis or, you know, even Jared Lucas who can get hot. So I don't think there's that threat. I guess you could leave Jordan Pope open for like six or seven threes, and that's the path for Oregon State. But as long as we stay locked in and play hard, I think we should be okay in this one.
Yeah, so they have they're an interesting team because, yeah, Pope has shot the ball very well from behind the arc in conference play, but the volume is not big. You know, I guess they played what, 13 games. He's made 20, so he's making like two threes a game at a pretty high clip, 39%. Glenn Taylor is shooting close to 40% from three. So they have guys that shoot pretty efficiently. I think on the volume side of things, though, they don't seem to have, you know, a lot of volume. They certainly don't have a guy like Lucas who you would expect, you know, but you're not expecting to send one guy to come out and have like eight threes against SC. I guess anything's always possible, but that seems somewhat unlikely. Conference-only offense, Oregon State last in the conference. The reason for that is not the 3-point shooting. They, like I said, they lead the conference in 3-point percentage shooting, but I don't think they just don't get a ton of their points that way. They actually try to get the points in 2-point shooting, and they're like second to last in 2-point shooting. So it's going to be a game like, you know, the way that matchup looks, it's like they're going to really struggle probably to score inside, but we're going to struggle to stop their threes if they can get, you know, get the ball moving around and hitting. The other problem they have is they're actually worse on the offensive boards than we are. So you don't find too many things. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, that's going to be a matchup where I think, you know, it's kind of put them almost in the category of taking care of business. And, you know, whenever you're in the road, it's tough to say that, especially when you're shorthanded. But, you know, I think especially if Reese is playing, I think we'll have enough guys playing that we should be able to kind of get things done. Oregon State's 10th out of 12 teams conference only defense. So, you know, it's the kind of game where we really should win it, but, you know, it's, you got to go out and actually win it on the court. You can't just win it on paper.
Yeah, no doubt. So I've got SC going 1-1 this week, Chase. I have us losing to Oregon and then coming back and beating the Bees. How about you?
Yeah, I think that's a fair enough prediction. I think it's a fair enough prediction. And yeah.
But I would say 2-0 is much likelier than 0-2.
Well, yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. So if we, you know, we come out of there with a split, we're kind of still, we're probably holding court, right? We're holding serve. We're probably at the 10 seed still. If we were to sweep up there, we're probably pushing ourselves closer to maybe even like a 7 seed. That'd be a big jump, but we're, teams are going to start losing a lot nationally. And if we, you know, if we were somehow able to maintain kind of like lower just numbers of losses as a power conference school, it's going to look better optically, and it's going to probably push us up some draft boards. So that's what we're probably going to have to do, obviously. So after this, this is a really obvious kind of tough road trip, but it's not by any stretch like the last tough road trip. We got to go up to the Mountain School. We have the Bay Area schools coming to the home games at Galen. Now the problem there is that those are very low ranked teams, so all they can do really is hurt you. If you lose, you can't really help yourself winning.
Yeah.
And then those are away games. And the Mountain Schools could both be tier one games, depending on how those teams look when we play them. And then we finish up with Arizona's games at home. So this is like a decently tough schedule to close out. I know there's been some people who speculate, oh, I think we might be able to win out. I mean, winning out would be, you know, that's really tough, especially playing without Josh Morgan for the next few weeks. I'm not anticipating that at all. And this game at, if you go by KenPom and Torovic, I think they have, this is the toughest game left on the schedule. And Utah just behind it. I kind of would agree with that. It's probably the toughest game on paper. Arizona home is going to be a really tough game. They're a good team, but I firmly believe that playing this Oregon team on the road is going to be tougher than playing at Colorado or at Utah, even with like the, you know, the altitude issues at those schools. Oregon's just quite a bit better team. I think more dangerous team, worse matchup for us than either Colorado or Utah.
That's where I'm at too, right? So you're talking about those four remaining quadrant one games, right? At Oregon, at Utah, at Colorado, Arizona home. I would probably have it as like Arizona home 1A, Oregon one, road 1B, and then Colorado, Utah, like 2A, 2B in some order. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd agree with that. I think it would actually be, you know, if it's 1A, 1B, then Colorado is the next toughest. And then Utah's the four. I mean, I would say, I mean, still a tough game. I'm like not hammering Utah here, but I think that's of the four. I think that's the least imposing game to me, mainly because I think at the end of the day, I think Utah really is a team comprised of one serious high major player that's really good in Brandon Carlson, and otherwise comprised of guys who are kind of like borderline mid-major talents. And Colorado has more high major legit players starting for them. And it's also their point guard, right? Because the difference between Carlson and KJ Simpson is KJ Simpson is going to have the ball in his hands almost every possession. So he's constantly putting pressure on you, and he's really good. And then, you know, DeSilva's had this kind of like sneaky, crazy good conference season where he's like leading the conference in 3-point percentage shooting, or second. Where is he at on
3-point percentage? He's tops. Yeah.
He's tops.
46%.
Yeah. Right. So, and you know, so incredibly efficient from three, and he's scoring like, you know, like 17 points a game in conference. So he's had a really sneaky good conference season. Of course, after that, things kind of get a little unclear on, you know, who's where and you never know who's going
to
show up.
That's a kind way to put it. Yeah. Unclear.
Unclear. Yeah. I mean, how many did Lovering have against us again? Like 14? I mean,
he had a lot of offensive rebounds in that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. 14 boards, 7 offensive, and 13 points. So, yeah. And then you throw in like the Tad Boyle factor, the obviously the altitude. I think they're a little bit higher in Boulder than Salt Lake City.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are. They've got to be.
There's that factor. No, I agree. It's a tougher game. They also they perform better at home than Utah. So they did. Wow, they did somehow drop a home game to Washington, which is pretty insane. But you know, I guess Washington, as we saw, they have talent, right? So they can, if they rise up to the occasion, they're capable of beating a lot of these teams. But Colorado, you know, they also have the home wins. They beat Oregon 68-41 in Boulder, right? They just wiped Stanford, who had won five in a row, 84-62. So they're capable of going on these runs at home that does make them tough.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So anything you want, what else should we turn to before we adjourn for the week?
So we can, you want to touch on the Isaiah Collier game?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know we almost forget stuff. So just a little, he was on ESPNU yesterday afternoon in LA time, playing a four-wheeler against one of the other top teams in Georgia. It has been said somewhere that Newton is like the number two team in Georgia. I think from what I saw, they were maybe the number five ranked team in the state of Georgia. And look, for context, Georgia is pretty high these days in terms of just sheer talent coming out of, you know, high school talent coming out of different states. It's not going to be the California level for a couple of reasons. One is like California is really a destination spot for a lot of national guys to come and play basketball. So you're really always going to get more. And it's not going to be like Florida has a lot of that going on too, obviously. But Georgia basketball has been pretty strong for, you know, producing a lot of talent. So it was Wheeler versus Newton. Newton is led by their own point guard who's going to UConn.
Stephon Castle.
Yeah, Stephon Castle. Taller, bigger, big point guard, like 6'6". Can really shoot mid-range. And you know, I think he's going to be a really effective college player. And I'm doubting he's going to be like the pressure to be a one and done. So I think he might be a guy that sticks around a couple of years from UConn and can be really effective. But it was a good matchup. Newton also has a guy named Newton who's going to Indiana. So a lot of Indiana fans are watching the game. Obviously, Wheeler also has Arrington Page who's going to USC and the kid going to Iowa State. His name escapes me right now.
Jelani Hamilton.
Jelani Hamilton, I watch quite a few Wheeler games. He's kind of hit or miss. I mean, he'll get really hot from the outside, and then some games he just kind of disappears entirely. This was a great showcase for Collier. I mean, he looked phenomenal. I think he scored like 28 points, at 6 assists, hit some outside shot, had some questionable looks from the outside as well. But really just was able to get the ball down the court and kind of control the action for the most part for the game. He could really get to the rim almost anytime he wanted to. And like I said, Newton is not like the second best team in Georgia, but they're one of the best teams in the state of Georgia. So this is like a legit team that he's going against and really being able to get to the basket almost at will. Pretty good game for Arrington Page as well. You saw a little bit of some of the skills he brings to the table. His shooting was also good. So what were your impressions of the game?
It was a, like you said, great showcase game for Collier. This is the best I've seen him play. I know he had a great AAU season, which kind of elevated him to the number one spot. But, you know, just instead of just watching those YouTube clips of him in AAU, like actually seeing him in a full game setting against, you know, Stephon Castle, who he's a good player, like you said. I mean, On Three just updated their rankings and elevated Castle to number five in the country. So yeah, he's 6'6". He's athletic. He's got some length. He's a really good passer. But Collier was just clearly the superior player. And that's not to say Castle had a bad game. He didn't. He you know, was really efficient from mid range and showcased a lot of skills. But Biancardi touched on this on the broadcast. Like every time Collier's crossing half court in transition, if you don't like load up with kind of multiple guys to stop him, he's just going to attack the basket and either get there and finish or make a play for his teammate. He's just a monster transition player.
Yeah, and that's where we're starting to see a lot of the people comparing him to Lonzo Ball.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was kind of, you know, on that bandwagon kind of throughout the season, but you could really see it in this one, combined with the deep shooting, right? Like Lonzo Ball would do that. He would take these deep threes for UCLA, and Collier hit a few really deep threes in this one as well. I saw the Indiana message board compare him to John Wall, and I think there's some similarities too with Wall. Wall's a little bit quicker, but Collier has a little bit more power to his game just because he's built like a you know, kind of like a wide receiver or a running back. But a lot of their, but both are exceptional passers, and both, you know, are just these dynamite transition players, with their biggest questions being their jump shots. So yeah, I would kind of say like Lonzo Ball, John Wall, that's the archetype you're looking at. All those guys have positional size. Collier 6'4", which really helps things. One play that really impressed me too was, there was a play where he was coming off a ball screen, and he's just a dynamite player out of ball screens. He'll you know, attack the rim, he'll make the right passing read. If you go under, you can just shoot the three. But this one guy kind of fouled him. He like bumped him kind of right around the 3-point line, and it should have been called. It wasn't called. But then he immediately made this like wraparound bounce pass to, you know, I don't know if it was Paige or someone else for a deuce. And it was just a perfect read. He sees so many things on the court that a lot of these guards just don't. So yeah, just really, really impressive overall. I think the one thing that there are going to be some growing pains with him is the shot selection. So he did have several deep threes. One was from the, you know, the Wheeler High School logo. But like, I don't think he's the level of shooter as like a, you know, not Steph Curry, but even like a really good college shooter. There were a couple of plays. I think he had one air ball, which was, I think some of that was fatigue. He had another one where he missed it off the front rim and actually got the rebound and got fouled. So he's going to have to learn, I think, what a good shot is, like what an kind of like an in rhythm three versus an out of rhythm three. He had one deep two that he took in the first half that was a bad shot. So that's going to be, I think, one thing he has to get better at. And then just defensively getting into a stance and playing hard. And I think, you know, that'll calm as the games get, you know, more important. But that's something he has to learn and get better at as well. I do think his off ball defense has a chance to be really, really good. He's got good, you know, the high basketball IQ, good instincts. I do think he'll be a pretty high steal guy next year as well. So overall, like, just phenomenal performance, best I've seen him play.
Yeah. Yeah. And just a couple notes. Like I watched quite a bit of Boogie play in high school, and he was a better 3-point shooter in high school than Collier is right now. So that should probably kind of, you know, be kept in mind. I think Collier, you know, if he takes a bad three, it's, you know, the issue with him is you can get so many high quality possessions when he's your point guard. You don't want to settle for bad threes, you know, just because, you know, if he does something better, just does pick and roll, the odds are really on a really good look are high, you know. So if he just settles for kind of a deep three sometimes, that's just not, I mean, look, if he's coming off a pick, sometimes it makes a lot of sense, but you know, just settling on his own is probably not the look you're going to want from him, because you're forfeiting like what would otherwise be a high quality shot. But yeah, in defense, look, he's just going to have to, you know, when these high school guys have to adjust to college level. I mean, the level of defense played at the high school level is just a complete joke compared to the level that's played in high major or even like mid major. I mean, low major, you know, once you get to college, these guys are playing a completely different level of basketball. I guess we should mention really quickly too, that Combine Academy played a game against Compass Prep right near me in Arizona here. Compass Prep's arguably the most talented team in the country, high school wise, right? I mean, just crazy amount of talent on their team. And and Silas Demery led Combine to a win over Compass Prep.
Yeah.
Shot the winning free throws. I think he ended up with 22 points. I mean, it was a really impressive game. One of the more impressive games you're going to see from a high school player. And I'm curious to see what we're going to do, as far as, we're going to have to play both he and Collier at the same time at points next season. I have a feeling Demery is playing himself into, like, you know, 25 to 30 minute per game type player. I don't know if he'll get all those minutes, but he's very much trending upwards. And I think he's underranked. I think he's better than whatever he's at 55, even in at 24/7.
Yeah. You know, speaking of that, On3 did, like, you know, like I said, they updated their rankings and Demery did get bumped. So he got bumped up to 40. So that I think is more in the range of what you're looking at with him. Cause I think like with the, if you're talking about a top like 15 to 25 prospect, you're mostly looking at a guy that's probably, you know, or at least potentially a one and done. Right. And I don't think Salas is quite at that level. You know, for several reasons, right? He's not like an elite, elite athlete, and he's not, you know, an elite knockdown shooter, doesn't have that kind of wing size. He's got pretty good size for a point guard, but, you know, he doesn't have the, you know, passing of, you know, Isaiah Collier, for instance. But yeah, I mean, he's a very strong defender. And, you know, he's, I hate to like use the phrase winner, but I think like he kind of encapsulates that with the season that Combine's had. They've only lost like, I think, two or three games this year, and they've played a really tough schedule. And I think these matchups are huge, right? Because, you know, not only do you see the stacked Compass Prep team that he has to go up against with, you know, they have a bunch of top 50 players on their team. Yuki Cook, Victorious Miller's on that team. Zayden High, who's going to North Carolina, is on that team. So they're loaded, and Demery was the best player on the floor. I mean, he's even got a few guys on Combine who I think were ranked higher than him, or at least, you know, around his level coming into the game. And he was clearly the best dude. So, you know, he has that two way ability where I think you're getting something out of him on both sides of the ball. And, yeah, I mean, stepping up and hitting those clutch free throws when you're down one with 2 seconds left going to the line and just swishing them both. That's, you know, really, really impressive for someone his age.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I cannot remember USC ever having, bringing in two ball handlers quite, I mean, you know, guards like of this level in the same class. This is pretty unique situation. And, you know, I'm very curious to see, I'm just really curious to see how Demery, you know, he interacts with Collier and how they play off of each other could be fun to watch. There's going to be some growing pains for sure, but you know, they're going to have at least one full season with each other, hopefully.
Yeah. I think it also, you know, it shows that you don't really need Bronny, right? Like I think, you know, Bronny's definitely, you know, worthy of being a take just on talent. But, you know, you have Collier, you have Demery, you know, with Kobe Reese, you know, Zion Malik. I mean, you've got a lot of guards coming back next year to the point where it just might not make sense.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I've been at. And, you know, Demery and Collier are different kind of players than Bronny. And we've talked about this before. Bronny is, he's very happy to kind of let the offense come to him, be very efficient, take an efficient three, even if it's a long three, take your efficient shot. Don't force the offense. Both Collier and, I mean, to a lesser degree, Demery, but both those guys will press it. They'll force the other team to try to guard them, to, you know, to make decisions, to try to collapse in. And, you know, Demery's not going to be as, his usage on shooting is not going to be as high as Collier's, but he will definitely drive the ball to the basket, force you to, you know, try to stop him in a way that's, you know, they're just very, two very aggressive players. And it will, it's going to be, I'm going to be fascinated to see how that turns out for next season. Just really quickly, did you see this halftime score for North Carolina against Wake Forest? UNC down by 22 points. Now, look, I say this, and SC could be down by 22 points at half against Oregon, so I don't want to make too much of this, but is North Carolina going to make the NCAA tournament?
I mean, if they, you know, if they didn't have light blue jerseys and their jersey said Wake instead of Carolina, then probably not, but who knows, right? I mean, they're defending runner up and they have the brand in North Carolina. I think that's going to come into play, but if you're just looking at resume, it's hard to argue for it at this point.
Yeah. And I guess at some point there's going to be discussion because obviously these are, you know, the two of the blue bloods, Duke and North Carolina, they're whatever it is, 8 miles down the road from each other. Both have new coaches the last couple of years. North Carolina, where Davis makes the championship game in a position to win it as an 8 seed. But just regular season wise, both programs after the coaching change are exhibiting some struggles, a lot of struggles. And I do think I feel like the writing is a little bit on the wall on both programs. Now, maybe Duke just got unlucky with Lively not being what they're expecting, and Whitehead not being what they're expecting as, you know, top five players. But I just get the sense that both of these schools might be looking for new head coaches sometime in the next 3 to 4 years.
It's tough to like look that far ahead. What I would say too is North Carolina does have this dynamite recruiting class already lined up for 2024. I think they've got 4 top 50 guys committed. And this is 2 years out. So that's kind of crazy the way they've been able to do that. But once UNC has this wave of like Baycott, you know, going and RJ Davis going, what's behind them right now? It's they're going to be relying on a lot of underclassmen and I guess transfers. You'll see Hubert Davis probably go the transfer route. And then with Duke, it's just, you know, you don't really have that elite freshman coming in, I think, in next year's class. I'm not a big fan of McKenzie Mbako. Jared McCain might be the best freshman they have coming in. So we'll see how he does. But they better hope they get Filipowski back next year. If they don't, I just, you know, I look at their guys and I don't see a lot of superstars in their current freshman class.
It would really surprise me if they got Filipowski back. I mean, I think anything is possible, but let's see. Peek over at these draft boards.
Filipowski. I think this is kind of the thought here is apparently the quote unquote plan coming in was for Filipowski to do 2 years because he has like pretty well-off parents. But again, like he's showing up top, 15, 20 on these draft boards, right?
And some of them, right. And he's essentially the best player on the team and he's a freshman. So when was the last time Duke's best player was a freshman and he stuck around for a second year? I mean, that's generally doesn't happen. Now, one of the things that could have happened would be, that Lively sticks around for another year and he turns out to be really good eventually, or Whitehead shows sticks around. Yeah. He turns out to be much better. Maybe Proctor does. I don't know. Mark Mitchell, I get it's hard to like
all these guys. Mark Mitchell.
Yeah, I don't see it either. I just, these guys have, they're just so geared around getting to the NBA as quickly as possible. But then, you know, there's only so many spots. There's only so many spots in the NBA. There's only so many spots in the draft. And other than Filipowski, none of these guys have really performed at a level that would warrant them going high enough in the draft. So I don't know.
The funny thing too, is if you look at their recruiting class for 2023, I think like 3 or 4 of those guys are 6'8". Like they just recruited like a bunch of these combo forwards to go along with Caleb Foster and Jared McCain. So that's kind of weird. Not really sure why. I mean, I suppose they're going to try to play him at like maybe the 3 and the 4. But, you know, a lot of these guys are just not going to play. And I don't know what they do about point guard, right? Because Jeremy Roach isn't that good, but he's going to be a senior. And is Caleb Foster good enough to supplant him? I think that's kind of challenging.
I think it would be very odd if Foster shows up and they're like, sorry, these are Roach minutes. Maybe they both play together, but then obviously you have McCain as well. They do have this like very, these riches of name recognition, but when it comes to on court, you know, it shows you like when it comes to on court that there are certain limitations to just recruiting these phenomenal, like, you know, top 15 players who are especially when they're one and done, and maybe they'll around for next year, then for next year, and maybe they're not. Obviously, if you have Banchero, you're loving it. You're loving life. But
right.
If your number one guy is Derek Lively, it's like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you could see a similar thing with Jared McCain and Tyrese Proctor next year. I mean, I know Proctor, like a lot of people think he's really good. I don't know. I saw that Miami game and he was just abysmal in that one. Let me find his stats. I think he had 5 turnovers, 3 yeah. points on 1 for 5 from the field with 1 assist and 5 turnovers. So just got completely dominated by the Miami guards who are good. That Miami team, they're going to be, you know, a force, I think, in the tournament. They're really good, experienced, skilled, and have good guards once again. So
they may end up winning the ACC too. We don't know right now who's going to win the ACC. Right now, Clemson, Virginia, Pitt are all 3 losses. Miami is 4. NC State is 4. That's a weird conference too. It is really a weird conference because, you know, teams like Clemson and Pitt are kind of like bubble teams, and they might, you know, both are in contention to win the conference. So
yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it's like, you know, would you say that Duke and Carolina are like 3 and 4 in their own state in terms of quality?
I guess you could definitely make the argument, I guess, right? So especially with Wake Forest is dominating North Carolina that way. Yeah. I mean,
Wake Forest already beat Duke by double digits this year, right? You know, NC State completely ran Duke off the floor, beat them by 24 in Raleigh. And then you have this North Carolina team that's just, you know, going to drop their 3rd straight here.
I legitimately think North Carolina is in danger of not making the tournament. We'll see what happens, but there's going to be pressure on how many different ACC teams can like credibly make the tournament, and maybe they make the cut. But you know, that they're a conference that rates lower than the Pac-12, and the Pac-12 is only got 3 teams. So it's going to look awfully weird if they have like, they show up and like, oh, we've got 7 teams. You know, I know you Pac-12, you've only got 3, but we've got 7 where, you know, it's not clear how the quality. I mean, I guess Virginia is supposed to be the highest quality of these teams, and I don't think they're scaring anybody.
And then just looking at North Carolina's resume, their best win on paper is against 11-12 Ohio State.
Yeah, that's been like their best win all season, right? I mean, I guess they won at the Carrier Dome, so that's like an impressive win, I guess. I mean, they beat North Carolina State at home, but they're this is they did beat Wake when they played them at home, so it's weird, right? Because the ACC just forever has been such a, you know, there's these true basketball programs where basketball is the most important thing, not football. And you know, when you're that's obviously not, it's Duke and North Carolina, but it's Louisville and now Virginia. And school like Pitt could be very important too. NC State for sure. Wake Forest for sure. And, you know, a lot of these programs are just down. Notre Dame is down. Louisville's down. Georgia Tech, historically a basketball team, is terrible.
Florida State, right?
Yeah, which has been kind of like carrying, in many ways, kind of carry the conference, pulled the conference up for several years, and they're bad. So I don't know how much of it is it money. I mean, it might be, some of it might be money. I don't know. I'm just not sure.
I mean, Jim Boeheim says that all of his ACC competitors bought teams, right? So
and he has no money. And like even though it's been publicly reported that their leading booster was willing to commit $1 million in NIL money to the top recruits, he's still saying like he has 0 NIL money. I mean, I've never wanted to like hate on Jim Boeheim because everybody else complains about the guy, and obviously, yeah, the tragic auto accident a couple of years ago where someone lost their life, which is not a joke. But I mean, his behavior the past, you know, couple of years has just been really, it's time for him to, I think it's time for him to like hang it up and try to enjoy his life, not worry about squeezing Syracuse into the tournament again and pulling a couple upsets and really just, you know, angering opposing fan bases. Cause they're just not, they're not doing anything in basketball these days worth talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there was a stat like he hasn't made the top nine in the ACC since 2014 or something crazy like that. I mean, he'll with their zone, like they, you know, in these tournament matchups against teams that aren't used to it, they can pull upsets. But just in conference play, I figured that, you know, after Buddy Boeheim was gone, that'd be it for Jim Boeheim. But
yeah. Well, here's the thing. He had both Buddy and Jimmy on his team last season. They're both playing their last years of college basketball. That was the perfect opportunity. Just retire, dude. Just, and no, it's like, no, he's got to stick around for some reason. I mean, who knows what reason is that he's got to stick around to keep doing this. But, you know. Well, bless his heart.
I think it's one of two things, right? It's either just keep cash and checks, or it's just about like legacy and trying to advance in the total win record book.
I think it's only the total win thing, right? How far behind K is he?
He's got a ways to go. I think he's still a few hundred, but he's number two, so I guess he's trying to like had his margin a little bit. Like you saw the thing where Jim Calhoun came back to coach this, like, I don't know if it was a D3 team, but it was just to try to add wins, right?
Was he trying to add wins, or is he just trying to, I guess he does get credit for those wins, huh? Was that what he was trying to do, or was he just trying to, like, you know, pass his time and coaching?
Yeah, maybe he was bored, right?
I don't mind if he's, look, I'm going to give him benefit of the doubt and say, he's probably just bored. But Boeheim's big thing is, right, he had a whole bunch of his wins taken away from him, right? Yeah, he had a forfeit. So yeah, he's like 200 wins bond, which he'll never make up 200 wins. You know, the rate he's going, that would, you know, take 15 years. So that's not happening. Time to hang it up. Okay. Anything before we get out of here?
That's all I got, Chase.
Okay. So we both got SC 1-1 this week, but the games still need to be played. So everyone tune in. If you're in the Oregon area, it would be great if you could show up and run on the team. But either way, fight on.
Fight on.